Alternative views this evening is relevant for any city, showing people at the top wielding power and people at the bottom struggling against it. You are looking at Austin's latest endangered species. Why are they endangered? And what is causing it? We'll find out tonight on Alternative Views News Magazine. This is a program which was originally recorded in the summer of 1979 with an update added a year later. The controversy continues today. There are at least four controversies going on concerning urban development or redevelopment or whatever you want to call it. Either putting up new housing and apartments, condominiums in places where there are none right now, or displacing people and putting something else in the place of it. We will focus our attention tonight on the controversy between the Board of Regents of the University of Texas and the administration of the University of Texas and the people in the apartment buildings of family student housing in Deep Eddy and Brackenridge. Those people are fighting for their homes because the university has indicated that it would like to demolish those homes within a year. We also will focus on the overall problem this is causing in Austin and relating it to some of the other situations that have occurred in other parts of the country. We'll see a documentary on this and then we'll discuss it with Dr. Al Watkins from the Political Science Department of the university. The upper part of Town Lake on the Colorado River is one of the most beautiful parts of Austin. On the south side of the river are nestled many expensive homes, which you can see peeping through the many trees which lie on the bluff overlooking the river. On the other side of the river, oh, that's quite a different matter, because on much of that area is located family student housing, which is owned and operated by the University of Texas. A lot of big bucks could be made there if someone could get a hold of that property and develop it.
This is the place where there's a big controversy right now, because the university is recommending to the Board of Regents that this area, the homes there, be demolished by August of 1980. And, well, who knows what could be put up in this place. Well, what about this area of Brackenridge? When you drive by, it looks kind of ratty, you know, old World War II barracks with the paint coming off. The mass media in Austin have done a hatchet job on this area for years. They publish pictures of babies, naked babies, playing in mud puddles, and also take pictures of somebody's dilapidated backyard or back door. That's about as far as it goes. They never capture the community. They never talk to the people who live at Deep Eddy and Brackenridge. So this is what we want to do tonight on Alternative Views, to capture the community, the feeling, the love of the place for the people, and, yes, even the beauty of Brackenridge and Deep Eddy. The Brackenridge apartments are frame structures which were erected in 1946 from World War II Army barracks. All of this wooden housing, and including the trailer park, house over 400 families who are going to the University of Texas. The people across the river in their big homes have a wonderful view of Brackenridge, starting with the trailer park and the duplexes, in addition to the regular large apartments. The Deep Eddy apartments are similar to those in Brackenridge. But who is Brackenridge, and just how did the university get this land?
Early days of the university, when the state was very poor and oil had not been discovered on university lands, had great difficulty getting money for financing of the university. And two of the chief benefactors were Major Littlefield and Colonel Brackenridge. Colonel Brackenridge was a Texan who was a Unionist, didn't believe in secession, got across the Rio Grande, organized a regiment of Union soldiers from the Union Texans who crossed the Rio Grande to not serve against the Union. Major Littlefield was a hero in the Confederate cavalry, a major in the Confederate cavalry. When they returned from the Civil War, they each went into banking business, they financed trail drives, they became very wealthy. And in the early days of the university, Major Littlefield would give some money, then Colonel Brackenridge would give some money. And they would tell, the regents would go to one and tell them that Colonel Brackenridge is going to give this, and or Major Littlefield this. Out of their rivalry, the university received a number of grants. Now, Colonel Brackenridge gave this land out on the river for the university. He was hopeful that the university would be built out there, and the Deep Eddy land, or the Brackenridge lands it's called. But, of course, the university was built on the 40 acres. But he provided in his will, when he left that land, that in event it should ever be used for anything other than university purposes, it would revert to his heirs. And his attorney at San Antonio at that time, Judge DeBrell, in writing the will, asked him if he had any objection to telling him why he left that reversion to the people of Jackson County. Colonel Brackenridge said the good judgment they used during the Civil War. Said a bunch of men came and took me out one night with a rope to throw it over a limb to hang me. They said that I was an abolitionist. That's what they called an abolitionist. They were going to hang me as an abolitionist. And as they were ready to hang him, he had voted against secession in Jackson County. And as they started to hang him, one man said, "Wait a minute, boys. Now, I ain't ever heard Breck say that he is an abolish, he's against secesh, but who's ever heard him say he was for abolish?" Well, no one had ever heard him say that he was an abolitionist. They discussed it a while, loosened the rope, and told him to get out of the county before daylight and never come back. They'd hang him if he did. He said that he had a good horse. He went south. He was over the line before daylight came. He hid out in the brush in the daytime and traveled by night till he got across the Rio Grande. And he said, "The people of Jackson County showed such good judgment in not hanging me back there at the beginning of the Civil War, I decided to leave the reversion of this land to them."
The beauty of Brackenridge and Deep Eddy apparently is never considered or even thought about by the local news media or by the University of Texas administration. The Austin American Statesman always refers to the area as the old barracks and to the building as shacks. But to the people who live there, there is a great deal of beauty, beauty in abundance. Legislator Mary Jane Bodie has a great deal of sensitivity and appreciation for the beauty and the community of Brackenridge.
There's no other place where people live in such beauty in very simple residences, but in natural beauty and with a spirit of cooperative life that has all of the good values that so many people say they're always searching for.
But beauty is not just on the outside. No matter what the exterior of the buildings look like, the people take pride in their homes and try to beautify them on the inside as best they can within their means. But regardless of the desirability of living in Brackenridge and Deep Eddy, the university wants to demolish the buildings. The UT ostensible position is enunciated by Robert Cook, the university director of housing and food services, in a meeting requested by the students after they found out that the regents were going to make a decision within 4 weeks.
The thing is, you know, I'm not going to say that the buildings can last a year, 2 years, 3 years, or what have you. With the kinds of concerns that have been raised, i.e. the energy conservation, which is in part spoken to by the gas bills that we have for these units every winter, the aesthetics in terms of the insulation affecting that factor in terms of the peeling paint coming off the buildings on a very consistent basis, the safety concerns in terms of the wiring, of the facilities in terms of their elongated life. Those are the kinds of concerns we have in terms of renovation and the need for something to be done if the facilities are going to be continued. Obviously, with inflation, with the cost of utilities going up, the cost of all the supplies and materials going up, I don't think we're going to reach a time, again, when Brackenridge and Deep Eddy can charge reasonable rents and still make their payments.
Cook pointed out that the maintenance costs of the new family housing at Colorado and Gateway are less than that for Brackenridge and Deep Eddy, resulting in a $33,000 deficit in last year's budget for the older apartments.
If we were to, how much more would our rent go up if we were to cover this deficit?
About $6 a month.
Yeah, and how much of a deficit?
I haven't figured it out. Is that what
it's about to? Roughly.
That's the
half. Yeah. And how much deficit is Gateway and Colorado costing?
They have no deficit, man. They're carrying themselves.
But they only cost $60, right, a year? And
for
we cost $100, and they're brand new.
Yes, ma'am.
So actually, our maintenance record is pretty good if we're 30 years old and we only cost $100 a month to maintain.
$135 a month.
Yeah.
We are the Division of Housing and Food Service and all its entities, all the housing that we run, are self-supporting operations. We get no money from the university. We get no money from the state of Texas. We operate off of, in your case, the rentals that you pay every month. In the case of the single students who live on campus, the room and meals payments that they make every month. Yes, ma'am.
Well, it seems to me that there's going to have to be some kind of federal subsidizing or state subsidizing, because what you've said is that within the next 2 years, at the very most, things are going to have to be demolished. And at that time, even at the construction cost at this time, it's going to be costing people $300 and up a month to live in them. Therefore, it will become impossible for students to go to the University of Texas. So it seems to me that what you're saying is that the problem isn't whether or not these are going to be torn down in 6 months or a year and a half. It's whoever is still at this university is either going to have to stop going to the university or they're going to have to go someplace else to get their education, because it will no longer be viable for anyone to go to school there unless they're making $20,000 a year.
Okay.
Especially, especially the people that live here now, because we are the people that cannot afford to live anywhere else. I mean, we are the poor people at this university. We got families. We're living on, you know, very little.
That's the main reason why that everyone's all of a sudden concerned in tearing this down. Now, you may not realize that, but I know, my father knows most of the people that are on the Board of Regents for UT, and they have been talking for the last 8 or 10 years about tearing this down and putting up something really nice, like condos, or something like that.
Well, you know, if that is the case, you're right. You do know a lot more than I do.
Sure.
As I said, I cannot speak to the emotional issue. There is no way that I can say to anybody here that would satisfy the emotional kind of concern. All I can do is present to you what I know is the factual kinds of things, and my reaction would be, if I lived here, maybe they need to be demolished, but not until I graduate.
It's not an absolute question. It's a relative question. We live better than people live in India, many places. Okay, so if you're going to say these places are not suitable to live in, not suitable to live in for whom? We feel that, like, we live comfortable here. I don't think regions will feel comfortable here.
One person then asked Cook if the thought ever occurred to him that people actually might like living here.
No, man, it really didn't.
Perhaps that's the big problem, or one of the big problems. The upper and upper middle class strata of the UT administration just can't comprehend the lifestyles, culture, and community which exist at Brackenridge and DePetty, much less appreciate them. However, legislator Mary Jane Bodie certainly does.
I know very well the sense of community they have there. I feel that this is a spirit that is lacking in most of our society today. As someone who's been around for a long time, I can remember when I was first married, when I was studying, when I was raising my children, we did it together. I learned how to sew because the wives of other students taught me how to sew. We learned how to cook together. We learned how to raise children together. We learned how to handle life together. And this is very important, and it's lacking almost any place where we live now, except maybe within the confines of a laundrette or the YWCA. I don't just mean for women, for men and women. Learning these things together with their children.
I'm a fly with their children.
No!
I can do it if you've got
no back here. Good shot, Everett.
Okay, that's what, frisbee golf?
Yeah.
How do you play it?
Actually, I call it disc golf.
Disc golf?
Yeah.
What's that?
That's frisbee golf.
And you play it here?
Yeah.
Where's your course?
In Waterloo Park.
Where's your course?
It's here. All over here.
All over here, all around in the woods and all?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a real good atmosphere for kids. Because they're all, you know, it's kind of a small area, and they're close together. And, you know, the kids can just, they walk, you know, down the street, and there's all their friends, and they have football games and things like that almost every day. And there's the shuttle bus that comes by here, and you can just get on that and go almost anywhere in town. And there's a river, you know, kids can go out and fish and things like that. And there's an Olympic-sized swimming pool. And, you know, that's, everybody goes up there and meets each other. Most everybody, you know, there's hardly any theft or anything because everybody's friends. And, you know almost everybody here. And not that many people have stuff that's so valuable that you'd want to break into their house and steal it. And, you know, people watch out for each other's kids. And I think it's basically safe.
The apartments aren't really that bad, you know, because you can do what you want inside with them. You know, we painted my room, I fixed up the way I wanted to, and, you know, everything's nice, nicer than any other apartment I've been in, really. Another advantage to living here is for kids is that being near adults is helps you to mature faster. And I've been around adults, college people all my life. My mother's been in college for several years, and I think it's really helped me to mature faster and better. I'm more independent too.
The location and atmosphere of the community in Brackenridge and Deep Eddy encourage the pursuit of a variety of interests, diversions, and lifestyles. This provides an ideal environment for the nourishment and replenishment of the mind and the spirit.
What does the garden mean to you here living in Brackenridge? Is it important to you and a lot of people?
To me at any rate it is. I enjoy it a lot. It's good recreation. It's also, I don't know whether we end up saving any money on it because it costs a fair amount to do it, but we've also gotten a tremendous amount of produce. But it's fun and healthy and the food's good. And so I enjoy it a lot. I've never done it before. It's the first place I've ever lived where I've had a garden.
Because the Town Lake hike and bike trail is only a half mile away, many Brackenridge joggers and bicyclists use it. But as pleasant as it is to live here, that's not the main purpose of Brackenridge Deep Eddy Apartments, which is to provide low-cost housing for people with limited incomes. The closing of these apartments could create severe, even cataclysmic problems for its residents.
There's always a possibility that I could come back to school and Janelle live with her folks, but that would be, well, for us, that'd be almost out of the question. We're, for us, having the family together is one of the most important things in our life, and even more important than the education.
As a single parent, I would find it difficult, if not impossible, to pay standard rent in Austin. And it's a means for me to continue my education. And Brackenridge has also been a very pleasant place to live.
Well, the present situation is this. Of the 41 to 42,000 students in the University of Texas, the University of Texas has housing for a number. They have housing for approximately 5,500 single students. They have housing for about 1,000 family units and for families. Of those 1,000 families for which the University of Texas has housing, of course they pay rent on it, 569 families, over half of all the families who rent housing, student housing from the University of Texas, are in the Brackenridge apartments. They were put up right after World War II, primarily for veterans who had little money to go to college. They're still rented to low-income students. That's the greatest group of low-income students in the University of Texas. And if they're torn down for somebody to build some big complex or build some tall apartments or something at high rents at $300 a month, those who pay less than $100 a month, my information is most of those families would be forced out of the university. I think a great university of the first class ought to offer opportunities to people to go, both single and married people. Families of low income, to give them an opportunity in life. It's to educate the whole people. This is a state university. It's not a rich university for a few rich regents to play with, to put that $600 million in the fund, in the endowment funds acquired from the oil lands in their favorite banks. I think perhaps we might need a different kind of tablet to honor regents. We put a tablet on every building with the names of the regents who built it. Well, a lot of them tore down something to build it. And if they tear down the Brackenridge apartment, cut off that opportunity for those families of limited income in Texas, in addition to putting a plaque on the side of the big building they build, I think we ought to put one up and put the names of the regents who tore down the modest income housing for the students of modest income.
I asked Ralph Yarborough if he had heard what was planned to be built at the Brackenridge Deep Eddy sites. He said he hadn't heard anything specific.
You know they're not tearing those buildings down because they're an eyesore. They're tearing them down to let some fat cat contracts.
If these people had to move, where would they go? Where would you put more than 400 families when it's almost impossible now to find any rent property that will take children that's anywhere near the university area? How would they pay? Because the rent that they're paying at Brackenridge is about, they estimate one-third, I'd say one-fourth of what they'd have to pay for comparable space anyplace else. How would they get to classes? Now the Transportation Enterprises is right at their door. It's energy efficient. They don't have to drive their cars. They don't have to hassle about parking, and they don't add to the clog around the campus. And I just see so many minuses at this point that I've been trying to convince people within the university system who will ultimately make the decision that they must look at these aspects.
Realizing the danger therein, the students start organizing. They form a neighborhood council, elect officers, form committees. Even the children have a vote. They know they only have a few days before the regents make their decision, and that the burden of proof is upon the residents of the housing area, not the regents or the university. The students have many resources and contacts, but they know that they're up against a great deal of power, which can be used arbitrarily. So the students are gathering information, contacting experts, making canvases, writing letters, and doing research into the validity and accuracy of the university figures. They also are negotiating with the one regent, John Newton, who originally publicly pushed for the demolition of the homes, trying to ascertain just what is needed to deter the dread decision by the regents.
The only way we can approach the regents and hope for any kind of success is to have the facts in hand, and that the only facts they would accept would be official reports signed by professionals. That is the only thing that they would accept. So we're putting all of our efforts and energy into doing this.
Southwest Insulators here in Austin do an estimate for us on our insulation. According to Dr. Cook's or the housing department's figures, it would cost $500 per apartment to insulate pipes. And he says the figures are so high not because of the price of materials, but rather because of the price of labor. We took a different route and decided we pay a little bit more for materials and a lot less for labor. He came up with $500 per apartment. We came up with $60 per apartment.
Words of Dr. Robert Cook, Cypress cannot be painted. Well, I went to Dr. Taniguchi's architectural firm. This just completely shoots a thing off the wall. He was horrified that the university claimed that they couldn't paint it. He said Cypress does have certain problems, but that basically you can paint it, you can do anything you want with it, but that it's a lovely, lovely and very durable wood to use for a siding in a building. So that's the more good news.
Wanted to report to the group that the council had written a letter to Dr. Flan, the incoming president, to keep him posted on developments. And Dr. Flan was out of town, but apparently the message reached him, and he returned, he responded to our letter with a telephone call the same day that he received the letter. And I said, Dr. Flan, this place is like a hive of angry bees with people crawling all over these buildings trying to get to the facts. And he laughed and he said, oh, you don't have to tell me about those people out there. He said, I lived out there, you know, in 1311F. And there was a pause and he said, and I don't mind telling you, it saved my life.
Everything that's happened this week, first of all, leads us to indicate that the university's reports are not as thorough as perhaps they could be, that they plan for renovations that are much more extravagant than what we need or would want for modest student housing, and that the prices they indicate
are extremely high, even for what they're trying to do. So all of our actions have been into finding alternatives to this. Everyone we're getting has to be a professional, and they have to be able to sign their name to an official report. This official report has to be compiled and given to Newton, hopefully during this coming week, and presented to the entire Board of Regents.
All of the students realize they have a very serious problem. How to approach the regents in the most effective manner. The students are divided on this.
And I think that if we go there in what they may consider picketing or whatever, this pressure, that is not going to be to them an honorable solution. But I think that they do come from their value system. And, you know, the Pope likes audiences, but I don't think the Board of Regents do.
I think that regardless of whether we picket, hold signs, shake their hand, I think we should have bodies there to show solidarity. Show that it's not one or two people that went out and worked their butts off and got this information, but it's 20 or 30 people that care and want to show that they care.
If they don't, after we present all the facts, we can escalate instantly. We can start with pickets. We can start with demonstrations. We have the political coalitions all lined up. We can sit outside every board meeting they have. We can do anything after this. We are approaching them on their terms. We're approaching them with the facts. We must assume that they will look at these facts, not go against us. If they do, all hell will break loose.
It is put to a vote. The group chooses the more conciliatory, conservative approach to the regents. The next day, at the request of the neighborhood council, three experts will make an inspection of the housing area. Their opinions will be of vital importance to the students. They are Gary Ashford, architect, Alan Taniguchi, the former dean of the University School of Architecture, and Bill Forsyth, an electrical engineer and contractor. They warn the students ahead of time that their report will be thorough, realistic, and honest, and that it might even undermine the students' position.
You know, it goes back to what Alan's saying, is that you're really addressing people whose values are in the upper middle class to upper class strata of our society, and they don't have any understanding of what it's like not to be able to afford these things. And their levels of comfort are less adaptable than someone who is struggling to get started in life. So.
All right. The electrical systems in these apartments that I looked at are in better shape than I had expected. I looked particularly for, is there something wrong if you burn the house down or somebody gets shocked and electrocuted? And I just don't find any evidence like that. And people that I talked to, they're not having any particular trouble with their electricity. And in only one apartment I found so far that she had a high bill. So I think that the electrical systems are the least of the problems here.
They discuss the outside wiring, of which there is a great deal in these buildings, and which was criticized by the fire marshal's report.
Okay.
Sheathed cable.
That doesn't worry me from a fire standpoint. In fact, from a safety standpoint, it's better to have it on the outside. You can see it if the insulation deteriorates or if something starts to smoke, you can see it right away. And it's not susceptible to any physical damage.
Was it Leland Priest that did the report, or was it just one of the fellows?
UT Fire Marshal.
Oh, UT Fire Marshal. Wasn't the city. Well, what he's worried about is in case the unit is on fire, that will burn, but then so will the wiring inside a house, too. Or he's worried about vandalism,
about
perhaps.
History of fire.
Somebody cutting it.
What was that?
Almost nil. The fires we've had out here, we have an excellent fire record because everybody's very safety conscious.
Sure.
I think it's amazing.
Jane Jacobs, everybody's watching everybody else's.
All of our fires have been due to an old fan that overheats, or top of the stove, and that's the most typical.
Top of the stove.
And the
flues. Any flue fires from the gas furnaces? I'm
not
surprised.
Not one furnace fire. And the last time we had a big fire, I talked to the electrician afterward. The fire was in the utility room, which seems to me
a very vulnerable spot for a fire. Well, as far as where your wiring is and everything. And he said that when he went in there, first of all, he saw the studs, and they were still sapping. They were still green, in good condition. And he was very surprised. He expected the wood to be dried out and brittle. Yeah. And that he used the old wiring as much as he could and used a minimum of the new wiring because he felt that the old wiring was superior. It was in excellent condition. It was copper. It did have cotton batting. But he felt better about it than what he was replacing it with and used a minimum of it.
Apparently, is it the university administration that wants you to have a minimum of 15 years worth of life left? And I haven't seen anything so far that would indicate these buildings are in any state of immediate danger. And the life of structures being what it is, I don't see any reason why these couldn't remain standing for 15 years just as they are. If you look at the old Driscoll Scarborough warehouse down on Guadalupe Street, I know it hadn't had a coat of paint or anything done to it in the last 10 years, and it's doing fine.
Just may be that's what their image of this is.
Yeah, it may be. I hope they don't go tear down the Driscoll Scarborough warehouse.
Look what you've done there.
There are a lot of questions which need to be asked by the mass media and by the people at Brackenridge and Deep Eddy themselves when they attempt to try to fight this possible decision which the regents will make in a few days. These are questions which usually are considered no-nos, such as if this does take place, if these buildings are demolished, and if the university cannot put up housing which would be within the range, economical range of the students to live in, such as they've said, anything they can put up would be over $300 a month for a two-bedroom apartment. Well, then, what would happen? Would land developers lease it from the university? And if so, who would benefit? What land developers? What construction companies? What banks could be involved? And what, if any, are their relationships with the university and the Board of Trustees? Also, what about the accessibility to information? Will the university open up its books so that the residents, the neighborhood council there, can find out just how the accounting process goes on? How valid are the figures which indicate that Brackenridge apartments cost $135 a year in maintenance compared to about, well, a little less than half that of the newer apartments at Gateway and Deep Eddy? Brackenridge has and Deep Eddy have such rich cultural and emotional ties with the people. Where else could you let your children run free in safety? Where else could you live in such peaceful harmony with people from other countries, from speaking other languages, and from other races than your own? Where else could you find a place where a woman, such as she lives there in Brackenridge now, actually grew up there while her parents were going to school, and now she's back attending, getting her education? Or even the situation of two families where the parents or the mother are living there, getting their education. They also have married children who are getting their education, living in family student housing also. We have Professor Al Watkins of the Government Department of the University of Texas with us. Al, do you have any comments on this Brackenridge Deep Eddy situation? You're kind of an expert on this type of thing and teach some of this in some of your classes. What does it look like to you?
Well, I think the most interesting thing about the Brackenridge Deep Eddy housing situation is that it's part of a, or at least it strikes me as being part of a much larger process of downtown revitalization in which various members of the financial industry and the building industry are getting together and trying to essentially remove people from their homes, remove people from the land that they are occupying presently, either as businessmen, business persons, and as homeowners or renters, and trying to upgrade the land to what the business community considers to be, quote, a higher and better use. But in reality, what it is, it's just a grab for profits, and the needs of people will be subordinate to the needs of businessmen and their balance sheets.
Well, this is something that's been happening all over the country in the big cities for years. Right now, it just seems to have come you know, full force into Austin. Does this mean that suddenly we're a big city and don't realize it yet?
Yeah, I think Austin, well, I think it's the 47th biggest city in the country today, so certainly that makes us a big city to start off with. And you're right, New York City and San Francisco and Chicago and Philadelphia and Baltimore, you can just go down the whole roster of major cities. They've been having these, they've been fighting these fights for the past 15 or 20 years. It used to be known as urban renewal, now we call it downtown revitalization. The name has been changed, but the process is still the same.
Well, how can they do this? What type of due process, which our Constitution says we are allowed, can be affected like this?
Well, I think the major thing that goes into downtown revitalization is you've got to get some sort of approval from the federal government that the area that you're dealing with, that the area that's going to be urban renewed or, quote, revitalized, is dilapidated. And so the city will go out and take a survey of the buildings, and they will go and find various structural defects. They may be minor little things like an electric light switch needs to be replaced. But if they find a few of these violations and they want to be very strict with the code enforcement, which they never are, they can then turn around and declare the building condemned. Now, the reason they want to declare the buildings condemned is they want the area that they're interested in to be termed an urban renewal area. Because once it becomes an urban renewal area, then the banks, the real estate individuals who want to buy up this land don't have to go into the free market to purchase it. In other words, if you have a plot of land and I want to buy it from you to put up a Hyatt Regency hotel, for instance, I would come to you and say, I want to buy your land to put up a hotel, and here's $100,000 for it. And you might bargain with me and say, well, since you're putting up such a big hotel, I'd like $250,000. I know you can afford it, and my land is valuable. Give me $250,000. If it becomes an urban renewal area, then essentially what happens is the city condemns the land, and they buy the land from you at a price which they set. The price which they set is what they consider to be a fair market price for the use of the land as it's being used today. But of course, you're not interested in the value of the land on the basis of what's on it today, but rather the fact that someone is going to put something very expensive on it tomorrow, and so when you sell out, you're going to ask for a higher price. With eminent domain proceedings coming in, the city basically condemns the land, and you have to accept the price that the city offers you. Then the city turns around and sells the land to the builders and to the real estate industry for the same price that they bought it from you, and essentially the real estate industry and the builders don't have to worry about the free market supply and demand. The land is taken from you by government fiat and given to the real estate industry at the same price that the city bought it from you.
That's so where the big bucks come from then, right?
That's where the big bucks come in, because the real estate industry gets the land cheaply and then can do whatever they want on the land, and they're paying the city the cost that that the city incurred to acquire the land, but yet you're not getting a chance to sell your land on the free market. It's another example of business going around the free market whenever it suits their needs. Free enterprise for the poor and government assistance for the wealthy.
Well, what about the Brackenridge Deep Eddy situation now? They don't even have any safeguards as far as eminent domain, right? The university can do with the land, since it's state land, they can do with it what they want to, or is that oversimplification?
Well, I would imagine that the regents can utilize the land whichever way they see fit. If they want to tear down that property, I'm not a lawyer, but I don't know of any reason why they wouldn't be able to do something like that. Now, of course, Brackenridge and Deep Eddy is prime lakefront land, and it always sort of struck me as being very ripe for redevelopment, because after all, you could sell that land for high-rise condominiums, for office development, for shopping center. It's beautiful land, and why should you have a bunch of married students who can't afford to pay high rents living on it?
Well, what are the alternatives that can be pursued, something like this?
Yeah, well, I think before we even talk about alternatives, the main thing we have to realize is that when people get displaced from their homes, there are very few safeguards and very few guarantees to assure that they have decent housing, decent replacement housing. So what you often have is solidly constructed, low-income housing being ripped down, and then you turn around and you find that these people are displaced, and the only place that they can move to is very expensive property, which they can't afford to pay the rent. So with that as the problem, we then have to think of solutions which address precisely that problem. And some of the solutions that have been tried in other cities and are spreading quite rapidly throughout the country are things like union pension funds, the use of union pension funds. At present, unions have approximately $500 billion in capital, which is their money, which their workers have contributed towards their pension funds. At the moment, the union pension funds are put in the banks, and the banks invest the union pension funds the way they see fit. The union members, the union leadership, has no say in how this money is being invested. Well, a lot of people, including a lot of union leaders, are beginning to talk about using the union pension funds to give low interest, or lower interest at least, home improvement loans to poor people, and say, well, the banks are charging you 12% or 13% to borrow this money. We can lend it to you for 7 or 8%. Take this money, upgrade your home, improve it, make it so that it is structurally sound, so that it'll meet all the city building codes, and that way we can preserve the homes for those people who are living in them currently, instead of ripping them down so that the building industry can make a phenomenal profit off it. The other thing that's been tried, and believe it or not, it's been tried in Chicago, which is not known as a bastion of liberalism, is the city has gone out and sold tax-free municipal bonds. And then they take the proceeds of these bonds, and because they're tax-free, the interest rates on them are much lower than a normal interest rate would be. So maybe the city can borrow $100 million at 6% interest. The city turns around and lends out that $100 million to homeowners. And they again tell the homeowners, well, here's a loan of 7%, fix up your house. Well, here's a loan for 7%, and we'll give you a 30-year mortgage on this loan. Go out and buy yourself a house and improve the house in the neighborhood and rebuild the city for yourself and rebuild the city for us. And we realize you can't do it at the exorbitant interest rates that banks are charging, but since we can offer you the money at a lower interest rate, we'll be happy to offer it to you at that lower interest rate. And then you go out and do what has to be done to improve your neighborhood for yourself.
What about relocation of people once they are ousted by the process of urban redevelopment or whatever?
Well, here in Austin, for instance, the various officials involved in downtown revitalization are constantly talking about the fact that if there is any relocation, and they say that there will be some, they say, don't worry about it, there are federal guarantees. Your rights are protected by the federal government. Well, just ask the people in New York City, ask the people in San Francisco or Chicago who've been displaced in order to build a highway, in order to build Lincoln Center, in order to build some luxury downtown housing, or some luxury boutique shops like the Galleria in Houston. There are federal guarantees, but everyone realizes that they're a joke. And there are reams upon reams upon reams of books in Perry Castaneda Library here at the university, which just are case studies of people who have been relocated and the lack of due process and the lack of federal guarantees. The government, for instance, comes in and says, if you are relocated, we will give you rent payment assistance for a year. But of course, you're not being relocated for a year. You're being relocated for the rest of your life. And so you may have been living for 20 years in an apartment where the rent was affordable. The government then moves you out. Your guarantee is that for 1 year the federal government will help you pay the rent payments in this new, more expensive apartment they forced you to accept. But then what happens at the end of a year? You either have to move someplace else because you can't afford the rent, or all of a sudden you find yourself spending all of your money to pay the rent.
You know, a lot of these things you're saying about the about the urban renewal in various cities, including Austin, some of those things seem parallel to what's happening down Brackenridge Deep Eddy, for instance. These buildings have been there for years and years, and it's only this year that they had a fire marshal come out and say, oh my goodness, these buildings are wooden and there's wiring that was put in back in 1946. Plus the fact that they're energy efficient because they are, you know, they weren't put together for that type of purpose. They're also saying, well, they're too expensive to maintain. Well, they could raise the rent $6 a month to each person out there, and they wouldn't be expensive to maintain. Of course, this is depending on their accounting also. But it seems like the process, even though it's different with the state, they're using the same type of procedures. Also, a hurry-up thing. Uh-huh. They brought this thing up about giving the students about 2, maybe 3 weeks to try to gather all their information up to refute the university's charges. So I guess there are parallels in the way the thing works, whether it's state or whether it's private, isn't it?
Yes, speed and secrecy are of the essence in something like this. If you're going to displace large amounts of people, you don't want to give them a chance to organize and to protest and to develop alternative strategies for land use. So one of the things is you keep it quiet, and then all of a sudden you announce it, and it's a fait accompli. People don't have a chance to do any alternative studies or to present any alternative views on what can be done. One of the other important things that we have to realize is that the city, the state, governmental agencies are very rarely concerned about safety violations, except when they can use it as an excuse to displace people. There are plenty of buildings with safety violations owned by, I'm sure, by some of the prominent businessmen in this community, and they are not being ripped down because they're making a profit off those buildings. But all of a sudden, you have an excuse to use safety violations, and then you use that as a way of throwing people out of their home. And why throw them out of the home? Why not, if it's state-owned property, why doesn't the state simply correct the safety violations? That strikes me as being good for the tenants and good for the state and good for everyone concerned.
Well, strange thing, here we have the statements that they should come down because they were built in 1946 and they're wooden structures. The wiring is 1946 specifications. Yet, how many homes and buildings are there in Austin and the United States that were built before 1946? That means all of them should come down? It's absurd. Half the buildings, half the homes in the country would have to be destroyed if they use those criteria.
Of course, and the thing with Brackenridge and Deep Eddy is its location on the lake, downtown, close to downtown, and they decide that why should relatively poorer students live in such prime real estate, and they're going to be moved out, just like some of the people in East Austin are going to be moved out because their land is too valuable to have poor people living on it, and it doesn't matter what happens to the poor people. The building industry needs that land, and the real estate industry needs that land to make profits. So the needs of people are very rarely considered in these type of decisions. It's only a question of the bottom line on the balance sheet.
Well, you just bought a house. You better watch out for any inspectors that may be sneaking around your backyard, boy.
Yeah, I hope so. I don't want them to displace me.
Well, thank you, Al. Appreciate you coming down.
Pleasure being here with you.
Great. I was in the Navy for many years, lived all various places all around the world, government housing, private housing, ranging from old Quonset huts in Guam to living in the home of a former French Minister of Forestry in Morocco, and also across the street from a sandy resort beach in Turkey, living in an apartment building in New York City, in regular suburbia in Virginia, in the Washington, D.C. area, in a little fishing village on the coast of Maine, a town of about 250 people, in a wooden frame house that had to have been built before the Civil War, and also in the planned community of Columbia, Maryland, between Washington, D.C. and Baltimore. But you know, of all these places, the one which I hold with the greatest fondness and have enjoyed the most is the past 5 years I've lived in Brackenridge Apartments in family housing. Well, now, there is one that came a little bit close to it. The one that was second best was in Hawaii. And these were old barracks buildings. They were made into apartments. They're just like the ones in Brackenridge and Deep Eddy right now.
Whatever the outcome of this situation, this will be no ordinary fight with ordinary people, which the university regents and administration have on their hands. Because these people are not only fighting for their homes, for their community and way of life, they're also fighting for a chance to make their way out of poverty, to make a better life for themselves. They feel very strongly about all these things, and they're fighting hard for them. This documentary was made in the summer of 1979. It is now a year later, and the fight is over. Linda Benskin tells us what happened.
The July Regents meeting, I really feel that the Regents were impressed. The Regents voted to delay any demolition for at least a year while the administration had to rewrite their reports. The next regents' meeting where it was on the agenda was in October. The regents got into an active debate at this regents' meeting, and the final conclusion was that the regents had an obligation to provide low-cost married student housing.
And what happened at the last regents' meeting?
At the last regents' meeting, all of this was overturned. It was a carefully structured meeting. The regents refused to even make eye contact with the students during their speeches. It was a puppet show. As a matter of fact, regents were overheard referring to it as that. How long will this show last before we can get on with our meeting? And that's exactly what happened. The students got up, nobody listened to them, and the vote was unanimous, completely in favor of everything that the administration wanted, and that was all there was to it. The regents overturned themselves, in other words. The result is that the architects that the administration appointed pretty well can do what they and the administration agree to do so far as new housing. And the new buildings look fairly nice, but in the range of $400 to $500 a month rent. Well, very few of the students make more than $5,000 a year, so very simple mathematics would lead you to realize that $400 to $500 a month rents are completely out of the reach of poor students.
Linda, didn't the students ask the regents to increase financial aid to compensate for the increase in rent?
Financial aid is simply not a reality at the University of Texas for most married students. And the regents and administration have done nothing to change this. The students are getting the same financial aid that they would get before the rent increase, so this prices them quite out of the university.
Linda, one-fourth of the families in Brackenridge and Deep Eddy are headed by single parents. Isn't this situation could be extremely difficult for them?
Yes, it definitely will. With the married students, a lot of times, as in my husband and I's case, we have a chance to take turns going to school, and one of us work full-time in the open market. When you're talking about a single parent, they have the responsibilities of a child to raise by themselves, so they can't as easily work full-time themselves. Plus, they can't do this trading off, so they don't have this opportunity to take turns going to school, and chances are most of them will never get back in once they have to quit.
Linda, the students have been forced out of the duplexes already. What's going to happen to these buildings now?
Right. Well, in a way, it proves that the students all along were right, even though we lost, because these buildings will not be demolished. They will be picked up intact and moved outside of Austin. At least 30 of them will be going to San Marcos, where a private individual will be renting them to students there. So, as you can see, the free market, in a sense, has proved us right in that these buildings were found habitable. They will be lived in by students in the future. The problem? University of Texas students can't live in them anymore.
Linda, what was gained and what was lost by the students in this struggle?
Well, the students lost the big things we were fighting for, which was continued married student housing for poor people up for at least 10 to 20 years in the future. What we gained was 1 year for these duplexes, 2 years for the two stories at Brackenridge, and 3 years for the apartments at Deep Eddy. This does represent a substantial number of students that will be able to finish their degrees within this three-year time frame. I think what we're really fighting is the momentum of a corrupt bureaucracy, and that was something which this many students had no chance against. And we also thought that the land played the key role, and now we feel like one of the keys in this struggle was the idea of eliminating poor students from the University of Texas. Colonel Brackenridge, who donated this land, built some dormitories on campus for poor students, specifically because he wanted the university to get rid of its rich boy attitude. Colonel Brackenridge has been thwarted here, and the Brackenridge Tract is returning to the rich.